In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Love now and
did you fall in love last
time? I love
her. Love.
Because you'll never love anyone but yourself.
For the love, love.
And I love you more than anything.
There's still love. Love.
From the New York Times, I'm Dan Jones.
And I'm Mia Lee. This is the Modern Love Podcast.
Today's essay comes to us from writer Kadeen Christie. And this essay actually made me gasp when I got to the end. And yeah. I don't gasp very often.
It's a fabulous story that feels like fiction and feels like fantasy, but it's real.
The essay is called I Met My Husband on the Maternity Ward.
It's written by Kadeen Christie and read by Shayna Small.
My birth story, which is also my love story, began nearly 40 years ago in the mountain town of Spalding, Jamaica. It has been told to me time and again by the two women who were there that April day, my mother, Lorna, and a stranger, Lurline, who was giving birth in the same open ward. My mother and Lurline lived in different towns, far from each other, and had traveled separately to the hospital in Spalding. At the time, men had no place in the maternity ward, so my father, Vivian, a farm worker, and Lurline's husband, Gerald, a pastor, were not there for the deliveries. Lorna and Lurline were expected to handle labor alone, with the help of nurses and doctors. These young women were the first generation even to have the option of giving birth in a hospital. They both had been born at home in crude conditions. Percy Junior Hospital in Spalding boasted no modern amenities. Patients had to bring their own food or have it brought, preferably in thermoses if they wanted it to be hot. Expecting mothers also had to bring their own gowns, bedsheets, even cloth diapers for their newborns. There was no privacy. Lorna and Lurline lay nervously in their adjacent beds. While curtains separated them, they were connected by their fear of childbirth. And it was that fear that led them to start talking. My mother was the first to go into labor, which began with a piercing pain that only intensified. As Lurline tells it, my mother began to moan and groan and quickly escalated to her mouthing unintelligible words in agony. Lurline was overdue and believed that she should have been the one to be in labor. Shifting in her bed, she maneuvered her swollen and wobbly feet to the floor and, cradling her protruding abdomen, waddled to Lorna's bedside. With her pastor husband, Lurline was a religious woman, a praying woman. She and Gerald led a small church in Cascade, so she prayed for my mother at her bedside. She later told me that witnessing my mother's agony was akin to watching a body being split in two. My mother moaned and thrashed as if possessed. Lurline was seeing childbirth for the first time, and it truly terrified her. She not only prayed for her new friend, but also for herself, for what she would soon have to endure, as she held my mother's hand through each contraction and breathed with her in unison. These women had grown up in a time when subjects like sexuality and childbirth were not discussed, not even between mothers and daughters. The nurses did not take pity on first-time mothers and offered no comfort. The nurses failed to realize, however, that my mother was in grave danger. She was hemorrhaging and growing lethargic, her legs shaking. Lurline told me that the brown of my mother's irises even rolled over to reveal pure white, and her mind seemed to ebb and flow from awareness to oblivion. When my mother's body went still, the nurses, finally aware of the danger, busied themselves around her as night fell. It would be many hours before my mother would hear her baby's cry, my cry, for the first time. On Monday, April 13th, 1981, my mother awoke to the sight of me being placed in her arms. My safe arrival was enough to calm the fear that had brought her to the brink. But she was desperately weak. The nurses decided she would need to remain in the hospital an extra 4 nights for observation. But my mother's happiness knew no bounds. Now it was Lurleen's turn, and the weight of her pregnancy was starting to drain her. She had thought she was emotionally prepared to deliver her baby, but seeing what my mother endured made her reel at the thought of pushing life from her own body. Then, the doctor came with bad news. Her baby was breech and would need to be surgically extracted. Lurleen hadn't anticipated this, but the doctor explained that her life and the baby's life were in danger. She might even have to choose between them. The words, "your life or your baby's," terrorized her. Lurleen wrestled with this choice as the doctor's warning rattled through her mind. She thought of the tumultuous yet tender days of her marriage, the life blossoming within her, and the moment she expected that she finally would hold the physical manifestation of her and Gerald's love. Would that still happen now? As her mind veered between visions of life and death, she turned to her only source of solace, prayer. She came to a decision. The baby's life had to be saved. Lurleen suffered alone with the gravity of this decision. Despite her husband's absence at the hospital, they managed life together, and it started building a home for the family they were creating. They maintained a farm and a church. Gerald had made the long journey to the hospital when it was time for his wife to deliver their child, but he was not allowed to stay, so he had returned home. As Lurleen lay in bed, she worried about how Gerald would react if he were to come to take his family home and learn that only his child had survived. She pictured his face, perplexed by the doctor's words. She saw his hands reaching for her in desperation and denial, only to confirm that his wife was, in fact, absent from her body. Lurleen inhaled the present, her church, her husband, and the life inside her. Then she exhaled, as if letting go of all that might have been, a long marriage, parenthood, their rightful future. Placing her hand on her Bible, she glimpsed her wedding ring. She had not removed it since Gerald had slid it onto her finger years before, but she decided to remove it now. It took great effort, as her fingers had swollen. Once it was off, she whimpered at the sight of her Bible and wedding ring. In life, they were her identity. But in death, they would be a memory. If she were to die, Lurleen needed Gerald to know what had happened during her last moments. As she approached my mother, holding her Bible and wedding ring, she felt guilty encroaching on such happiness, but she had no other choice. She didn't want to cry, but upon seeing my mother holding me, Lurleen's eyes filled with tears. She put the ring and Bible in my mother's hands with the request that Gerald receive them if she did not make it out of surgery alive. These symbols of love and commitment felt like cement in my mother's hands. She took a deep breath and nodded yes. Even if my mother didn't quite realize the extent of Lurleen's trouble, she knew how deeply she had come to appreciate their newfound friendship. Lurleen had one more request from my mother, which was to have her read her favorite scripture, Psalm 35. As the anesthesia traveled through Lurleen's body, my mother's words filtered through Lurleen's consciousness. Plead my cause, O Lord. On Wednesday, April 15th, 2 days after my mother had given birth to me, a new life safely emerged by a cesarean section, a boy named Antonio. At 13 pounds, Antonio was the talk of the ward. No one had ever seen a baby of such great weight. Sewn up with stitches, aching from her surgery and unable to sit up or move about, Lurleen rested beside her new friend, Lorna. Lurleen's delivery had been so traumatic and physically taxing that she would need time to heal. And so it happened that the nurse took Antonio from his mother and handed him to mine. My mother rocked, cuddled, and sang to us both, me, Kadeen, and Lurleen's baby boy. In time, although we lived hours apart, that baby boy would become my occasional childhood playmate, then teenage lover, and now husband of 15 years. Together, Antonio and I entered this world. And together, 4 decades later, and with 3 children of our own, we continue to revel in its mysteries and miracles.
Kadeen Christie lives in Fairhope, Alabama, with her family. Her husband is an artist and a minister. Kadeen shares more of her story in her memoir, I Am at Home Within Myself. After the break, a tiny love story about another baby and another unexpected coincidence.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Do I need to put headphones on?
Totally.
I only have my little boys, so we'll see how they do. I'm Sarah Reynolds Weston, and I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I wrote The Tiny Love Story, An Unexpected Sign. I was 30 and knew I couldn't have a baby. Accompanying my pregnant friend shopping one day, I pined over a striped onesie with a crab sewn on the backside. I told her if I ever had a son, I would want him to wear it. 8 days later, I went to church and saw an infant snuggled in his grandmother's arms. He was wearing the same onesie. At the end of that day's service, the Reverend announced that the baby was in need of an immediate home. 2 days later, he moved into mine. Now he's 8 and my son.
Was it painful for you to go shopping for baby clothes with your friend who was pregnant, knowing that you couldn't have biological children?
It was painful in some ways. She was my best friend, and she found out she was pregnant right around the time that I found out I couldn't have children. And I think I tried to comfort myself by supporting her through her pregnancy. I threw her baby shower. I actually made all of the bedding for her child. So she has like a quilt and a little ruffle for the crib, some curtains.
Wow. And you had been trying to have a child for some time at that point?
Yes, we had. So I had to go through a series of fertility tests. And I'd had reason to believe that I couldn't have children. That was just hard to digest and sit with. I fell into a pretty deep depression. My husband has had his good qualities, but there were a lot of traumas. And I don't think he responded very supportingly. And so it was a really painful set of time for me for a lot of different reasons.
So during this time, were you thinking of adopting?
I was. I had not relinquished the idea of being able to have a child, to bring a child into the home. And my husband had not firmly said no, but he did not really want to go through the adoption process.
Yeah.
And so I think we were a little bit at odds about it. So when I was in the store and I saw the outfit, you know, I had these maternal feelings, these maternal desires, but it just caught my eye.
Yes, the fateful onesie. What did it look like? And could you just describe it a little bit?
It is gray and white striped. It buttoned up the front. It had red ribbing around like the front where it buttons. And like right where the baby's bottom is, there's this little red crab that is like smiling kind of goofily. And it's just like this little red smiling crab is just like pop right over there.
Cute. Yeah.
It just seemed cute.
Uh-huh. So you didn't get the onesie.
Did not, but I told my husband about it that night.
And then essentially a week later, 8 days later, you're in church and you spot the onesie again. What happened next?
Yes. So at the end of the service, the Reverend would come up and give these announcements, and he was standing there. And the woman came up and joined him, and they said, what you might not know is this baby needs a home and he needs it by Thursday. And so if there's anyone here who is interested in, you know, fostering him to adopt, please let us know. And of course, that's incredibly unconventional. But the family had not wanted to go through the standard process if they could avoid it, because they didn't want the child to have to bounce around between foster care homes. And they were having a hard time just, how do you go around town and find someone to take a baby? And I'm not a crier. But tears began to pour down my cheeks. And I had all kinds of rushes of feelings and emotions and thoughts instantly. And I didn't think my husband would go for it.
Yeah.
And I felt a hand on my lap, and I looked over. And he whispered, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And I was flabbergasted. It's like, yeah. So they wrapped up the service and we kind of hung back for a minute. And we slowly made our way to the front of the crowd, and they took our name and phone number. It happened really quickly. I mean, in the best way possible, but my world turned upside down in a matter of like 2 days. I can't make sense of it. But what I do know, I really believe, is that we were all meant to be together, that we were linked, and that it's the greatest honor to be able to be his mom and try to help him navigate from a very young age the complexities of love and family and loss and success.
What's he like?
He has more energy than anyone I've ever met, ever. He is tall and skinny, like mm-hmm. his birth mom. Mm-hmm. He is going to tower over me in a matter of years. Mm-hmm. He tries everything. I mean, if he is outside and can move and jump over it or climb it, that is what he's doing.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate you guys inviting me to share the story.
Take care.
Bye.
Modern Love is produced by Julia Botero with help from Hans Buteau, Daniel Guimet, and Alyssa Dudley. This week's show was edited by Sarah Saracen. Our executive producer is Wendy Dorr. This episode was mixed by Corey Schreppel. And this week's essay was written by Kadeen Christie and read by Shayna Small. Special thanks to Kadeen Christie and Lorna Howell, and also to Julia Simon, Mahima Chablani, Bonnie Wertheim, Anya Strimian, Sam Dolnick, Lisa Tobin, Corey Sika, and Ryan Wegner at Autumn.
I'm Dan Jones.
And I'm Mia Lee. We'll be back next week with more stories from Modern Love.
Thanks for listening.